Down. I'm Cliff Gooding. I'm a grateful alcoholic. I'm sober since August the 15th of 2001, and for that short amount of time, I'm as grateful as I know how to be. And this is one of the best-looking bunch of sick people I've seen in a while, so good to be with you guys this weekend. And thanks, George, for inviting me to be here this weekend. I love men's retreats. I like coming to them. I like just sitting in the audience and being able. We just had ours in Oklahoma this last weekend. About 95 guys showed up, and I think the guy that led your first retreat, Scott Lee, was the leader at our retreat this last weekend. One of his guys, Johnny, out of Nashville. So I just came off a great spiritual weekend. I'm just about, 30 seconds from water walker status is really what I am. And so I love coming and being part of him, and so thank you all for inviting me. I'm really excited this weekend. My friend Joe is here with me. Joe and I have been friends for a while, and it's exciting to be able to do something with him this weekend. So we have no idea what's going to happen, but we hope it's good. That's all we can tell you, right? We just hope God shows up and he gets involved. How many people here just have never been to this retreat before? Is there anybody here who's never been here before? Oh, okay, so we got some guys. Right? Well, Joe's going to talk after dinner. It's going to get better, I promise you, after that. So don't worry about it. Don't worry about this part. Look for the next part. I think that's really great that your first retreat. I love doing these because I think there's something about when we get together that we're undistracted. That's just the guys together. I think that makes for a powerful weekend. And, it's not so much what Joe and I do this weekend. I mean, really not. I got a sponsor. His name is Bob B. He's over in St. Paul, Minnesota. And he says, we're just going to have a conversation. And the whole purpose of the weekends like this is so that we can start the conversation. And Joe and I are going to have a conversation. But what I know is that the really more important parts of this weekend are going to happen out when we walk over to dinner or after the meetings or when you're sitting out with somebody just one-on-one. When you finally give yourself permission to tell something that you've been holding on to, when you finally give yourself permission to break through that part that may help you walk more in the sunlight of the Spirit. So it's just, these are always exciting weekends. Mark got me all picked up. Thank you, Mark. Where are you, sir? I saw you. There you are. You're right here in front of me. That's that snake that almost got me. So Mark got me all picked up, and we drove out here. We just had a great visit and on the way out here. And then when we turned in the retreat center, this always happens to me when I'm coming to something like this. It's just this sense came over to me because I know what's coming. I know what's coming on weekends like this. And again, it has very little to do with what Joe and I might or might not say this weekend, but I know God's coming. And I know that there are going to be people here this weekend that will be impacted. Again, not so much about what we have to say, but what the conversation that gets started, that you all might continue, and again, that you might discover, uncover, discover, and discard over the weekend while you're here. So I'm excited to be a part of a weekend like that. I'm excited just to be where I know God will do some of his best work this weekend. I knew this was also going to be a great weekend. When I left this morning from my house in Oklahoma City, my neighbor was in his front yard, and he waved goodbye, and he used all five fingers. So I knew. I knew. It was going to be a good weekend, Will. And thanks, Will, for recording this weekend, man. That's a great service to do that. So I knew it was going to be a great weekend. And, anytime I get to spend time with people in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's a great weekend. And I was in Georgia a few years ago. I was with my buddy Randy down there, and I was doing a men's retreat outside of Atlanta, and he'd pick me up. And we went to this small town on the way to where we were going, and we went to a noon meeting. And we were there early, and there was this elderly lady who was probably about 10 years older than I am now, but this elderly lady was sitting in the room when we got there, and she said, "What are you boys doing?" And Randy, without missing a beat, just looked at her. He said, "Salting." She said, "Salting?" Said, "Yes, ma'am." Says so right there. Salt through prayer and meditation. We're here salting. So that's. So I hope that's what you're doing this weekend. I hope you're salting. I hope you're seeking something this weekend, Because I like being around seekers. I like being around guys that are interested in being further down the path. I'm interested in people that want to hear about their awakening. I want to hear about how they're staying awake. I want to hear how they're awakening more. You know, one of the greatest things we have here in Alcoholics Anonymous is in that 12th promise that Ryan, thank you for reading tonight, read tonight. You know, that idea that having had a spiritual awakening is the result of the steps. If I do steps 1 through 11, something's going to happen to me, even if I don't plan on it happening to me. I mean, I've sponsored guys that have come here and bet against it and said, I'm going to do this, but when it doesn't happen, you know, just want you to know I'm out of here. And now they've been here 5, 7, 10 years now, you know, still waiting for it to not happen to them. Right? Because if you do these things and if you simply, you know, give yourself an opportunity to have that happen for you, then you get exactly what that step promises us. That prayer God could and would if he were sought. These weekends are about seeking. These weekends are about being dialed in, you know, however many of us are here, in tune as a group of sober men pulling in one direction. That's how do we get closer to God? How do we get more awake? How do we move closer down the road? So it's exciting to be here and excited to be with you guys. I grew up in a small town in southeast Oklahoma, population 5,000. And I grew up about 13 miles outside that little town and on a farm or ranch, whatever impresses you the most. That's where I grew up. And I grew up with some really good parents. My dad was a Korean War veteran. He was a decorated hero in the Korean conflict. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. I had an older brother. He was 10 years older than me. And, you know, I don't think he really wanted me around, but he had me, and he was kind of stuck with me. The first 5 years of my life, we lived out in West Texas. I was born in Texas. Grew up first 5 years of my life in West Texas. But my mom and dad were from that little town in southeast Oklahoma, so mom wanted to go home, so we moved home. And I was 5 and thought, well, I'll just go with them because that seemed like the right thing to do. And I had good parents. Like I say, I had good folks. I mean, my dad taught me good work ethics. I mean, he was a guy that, you know, they were Depression era kids and they believed in working hard. And, you know, you gave them 8 hours work for 8 hours pay and all that kind of stuff. And good people. And my dad, he bought the little farm that my mother had grown up on, that her parents, my grandparents, sharecropped. They were sharecroppers. And my dad bought that place. And we moved out there. My dad bought a liquor store later on. He had a liquor store. We had ran cattle. We had a liquor store. So had all this stuff going. He was a hard-working man, hard-working family. And I'm going to tell you, I popped into this world, and I remember when my mother took me to kindergarten class. And I walked into that little red schoolhouse. I mean, she had me there early. And walked me down there, that little kindergarten class or whatever it was. It was still in West Texas. She had me spit shine, man. I'm early. And I remember when she opened the door to that little schoolroom, there might have been probably maybe 15. I would have said as many people as in this room, but maybe 15 kids there at those little bitty tables. And when she opened the door, all those kids' heads shot up and looked right at me. And in that moment of when those kids looked at me, something internally inside of me just flipped. It's like I became this effervescence of fear just gripped me. Looking at these kids thinking, my God, they know the answers to all the questions, and I don't even know what book they're reading out of. This idea that I have this feeling that I'm different from them. It's this idea that I'm late. My mom has me there early. I feel late. It's like we have a 100-piece puzzle set, and I'm missing one piece. It's the best way I can describe it. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I heard somebody, one of the first few days when I really surrendered in Alcoholics Anonymous, I heard him talk about restless, irritable, and discontentedness. And I thought, my gosh, that man's a genius. You know, I didn't know he's cheating and reading out of the book. I thought, my God, I mean, somebody has finally put words to how I feel. You know, when I got the book and I read over there the bedevilments, and I thought, my gosh, this is it. I'm a bedeviled person. In my whole life, I felt that way. This, you know, and how I see myself, my perception of who I think I am, of how I see myself in relation to everybody. You know, growing up in the 60s and in the 70s, you know, listen to great music like, you know, Jim Morrison, The Doors. And I can always see myself as this Jim Morrison kind of picture. You know, I have myself, I'm really kind of Eddie Munster, but I see myself, you know. I kind of see myself as this, you know, Lizard King kind of guy. And I'm nowhere near that. But I have this idea, this delusional thinking of myself, because I spend a lot of time reading books, and I have this fantasy life that I live. And I grew up out on this farm. It was I was a mile away from my closest neighbor, and that was okay with me. And when I was 11 years old, it's important for you guys to know, at one time I did have 11 years of continuous sobriety, but when I was 11 years old, under a big old weeping willow tree down in southeast Oklahoma, my brother opened up a tall boy can of Country Club malt liquor. Anybody in here ever drink Country Club malt liquor? For the rest of you all, that's God working in your life. That's all I want to say about that, right? He opened up this tall boy can of Country Club malt liquor, and he took a drink and he handed it to me. And I took a drink. And I don't know how long it took us to drink that tall boy can of Country Club malt liquor under that big weeping willow tree down there in southeast Oklahoma, that hot summer day. But I can tell you this, when it was over, when it was concluded, the magic of alcohol happened for me. Because everything I spent here the first few minutes describing to you disappeared. In that moment with my brother drinking under that tree, you know, Carl Jung talked about when he wrote Bill that letter, when Bill wrote him in the 60s saying, hey, Carl Jung, you're kind of a de facto founder of AA. You remember Roland Hazard? And he writes Bill back, says, oh, I remember Roland. And he talks about this spiritus contra spiritum, spirit versus spirit. This idea that it's a thirst for God, that the alcoholic's thirst is a thirst for God. But in that moment with my brother, it was like a spiritual experience. Because everything I described, that angst, that separateness, that different deal, that puzzle, I found my puzzle piece. It's like I've heard people describe it, it's like I took a deep breath for the first time. My skin finally fit. However you want to describe it, I understand it. I heard my buddy Ralph talk one time. He heard a woman in a meeting said, you know, when I drink, I get prettier, skinnier, and tittier. And he said, I identified with that too, you know. And I thought, hell, I do too. I identify with that too. It's whatever that is, it makes us feel like we finally fit. And that's what it did for me that day. And it's not so much, you know, what alcohol did to me. It's what it does for me. It gives me that sense that I'm all right. And gosh, I've spent 11 years not feeling all right. You know, not feeling good. I'm not sick, but I just don't feel good. And man, on that day, everything tumbled together. And my experience is I didn't become a blackout drinker, puke, and it was the end of my social drinking. That's not my story. But by the time I'm a senior in high school, I'm a daily drinker. You know, I'm a daily drinker. And it's hard to get booze when you're 17 years old. But my buddy and I, we figured some things out. I had a friend of mine. He and I had a zero-hour class. We met at like 7. And so we would get up and we would meet at like 6 in the morning. And there was a little Zippy Mart in this little bitty town that I lived in. And they had this little, you know, the rules were, or the laws were at that time, for women, it was 18 and men 21. So if you were a 17-year-old kid, it's important to have older women around you all the time, right? But we found this little Zippy Mart at 6 in the morning. It was just the legal drinking age was old enough to get your money on the counter. And so we would go every morning and we would buy an 8-pack of Pony Millers. The champagne, a bottle of beer. And we would get an 8-pack of Pony Millers and we would split them right down the middle. I'd have 6 and he'd have 2. And I would drink those and I could operate around those kids all day feeling okay. I could feel all right. Feel like I fit in, feel like I belong. Became a blackout drinker when I went to college because the chains came off. Because once I got away from home, because listen, I'm relatively a good kid. I mean, if I really look back at my life, I'm relatively a good kid. I don't get in any trouble. I don't get in any problems. I'm a good kid. I mean, I show up when I'm supposed to show up. I do what I'm supposed to do, but I like to drink because it helps me feel better. And I also have this. I have a photographic memory. So if I read something, I've got it. Now, the toner cartridge is getting a little low these days, but back then, it was in full force. So what I could do is I could read the material, come back and get 100 on the test, because I could just regurgitate the material. And that would serve me well, because when I went to school, I could go out drink. I could read the material, go out drinking, go to class the next day and do well. And I do well in school because of that. But I'm a blackout drinker in college. I tested out of a whole year of college because I could read the materials, take the test, and clip my way out of a whole year of college. I spent 3 years at Oklahoma State University in Stillwater. I went to the University of Oklahoma Law School. I was 20 years old when I started law school. I was the youngest guy in my class by far. And, you know, once again, I'm the youngest, so I feel different. You know, once again, I'm different from the rest of these people. And everywhere I went, I felt different like that. I got out of law school because I have photographic memory. I was first in my class the first year, ended up being seventh. When I got out of there, I got a great job. And, you know, it's one of those things. I remember the first day when I went to work for the law firm that hired me. It was one of those big, tall office buildings in downtown Oklahoma City. And I remember parking in the parking garage, getting out, and walking to work that day. And this cloud just kind of seemed to come over me. And maybe you guys have experienced this kind of cloud. It's a cloud that comes over me that says, this is the day they find out. This is the day. Right. This is the day. It's all up today. You're going to go in. They're going to say, we've made a big mistake. We now know who you are. And that kind of thinking pervades me. You know, that kind of thinking about, because all I think about is me. I think about me all the time. You know, we could be having a conversation. I'm telling you about me and say, enough about me. What do you think about me? That kind of thing. You know, it's all about me all the time. That's all I think about is me. And, you know, I never realized how much I thought about me till I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah. I mean, maybe you're like me. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, if they would have said this, Cliff, write down the top 100 problems of your life. Selfishness and self-centeredness never make the list. I mean, they don't even get on the horizon because I'm a giver. You people know that. I'm a giver, for God's sakes. That never enters my mind that that's the root. Matter of fact, I don't even see it as a problem, much less the root of my problem. But it seems to me, through a process of inventory, all I thought about was me. What you thought about me, how I think about me, how they think about me, how do I fit here, how's my relationship here. And when I drank, it just seemed it quieted all that noise up there. It just seemed to be quiet. And I'm going to tell you, I began to notice that my drinking was different than people. Once I got out of college, I began to notice there was some difference in my drinking. And I remember I'd been working at law firm about a week, and the guy says, hey, we're going to go out tonight. We're going to go out after work. He catches me about 1 o'clock. He said, we're going to go after work to have some cocktails. Now, I'm a country kid. Cocktail sounds sophisticated. It really does, you know. That sounds like something I need to be a part of, right? I need to do that. And so I don't know about you when people ask you about drinking, but when they ask me, I always have questions about it. And they're pertinent questions, really, like, what time are we going? I think that's a real question you need to ask. What time are we going? Where are we going? That's a good question. Where are we going? And who's going with us? That's always good to know, because you might need to recon some bodies from time to time. So I need to know those questions. And I ask him on a day, what time are we going? Who's going? Where are we going? And he told me. He said, we're going to leave about 5 o'clock. We're going to go here to the Skirvin Hotel, bar called Pinstripes, be me, you, and a couple other people going. And you know what I said? Without even knowing where this was, I said, I'll get the table. I'll get the table. Because I don't know how you people drink. I don't know what it's like, your alcoholism looked like on you. But if somebody called, let's say if Rick had called me up and said, hey, Cliff, Saturday night, we're going to go drinking. We're going to go out about 9. I'd say, I'm in. But I don't know about you people. But I don't wait to 9 o'clock to start drinking, right? I start drinking at 6 to get ready to go out as a night, because I just can't go out. I got to get ready to go out. And I didn't know this about me at the time, but I said I'll get the table because I need to go get ready to drink with these people, because I drink different than they do. But I didn't know that. So I got there at 4 and I started drinking. And I'm a drinker. I'm not a sipper. There might be some sippers in this room. I'm not a sipper. If you put me a vodka rocks up here and you fill it up, I just drink it all at one time. I don't sip on it. I drink it. I drank that way from the beginning. If you filled it, I drank it. And I need another. I just need another. And so I'm there an hour before these people wander in. And they showed up and they got there right about 5. And I'm already well oiled by the time they get there, you know. And they sit down at the table, and the cocktail waitress comes over and takes their order. And then she goes away, brings her drinks back. And then about, you know how this works, about 10 minutes later, here she comes again. And she starts to ask the pertinent questions because she just looks at me and nods because she knows I'm in. And then she looks at the fellow who's sitting next to me, and this guy's got about a quarter of his drink left. And she looks at him and says, "Would you like another?" And he looked at his watch and he said, "You know what? My wife's cooking dinner. It's going to be ready in about 30 minutes and I got to get home. So I just need to tab out." And with a quarter of a drink on the table, this guy got his tab, paid it, and presumably went home to his wife. I don't know. But and I don't know if he drank again that night, tomorrow, next day, next month, next year. I don't know if he ever drank again. I don't know. And looked at the other person, this lady sitting there. She had about half of a drink on her table, on her, in front of her. Looked at her, said, "Would you like another?" She says, "No, you know, my daughter has a soccer game in 45 minutes, and I need to get there." So with a half a drink on the table, she pays her tab, gets up, gets in her car, goes to her daughter's soccer game, gets there early, finds her, goes out and tells her, "Hey, you have a great game, I love you." Goes, sits in the stands with the other parents. Now, this is pivotal. Does not get kicked out of the soccer game, okay? Does not. After the game, she goes with the parents. They go have pizza. She may or may not have a beer or something else. She may never drink again that night. May not drink the next night. I don't know. Then there's the third person at the table. Now, this is the person that I know some of you all have encountered this person. This lady's sitting there, and she has maybe a quarter of her drink gone. She's got three quarters of a drink on the table. Now, some of you have seen that. Could be the worst case scenario, you know, where the ice is melting and the booze is overflowing. That's alcohol abuse in this crowd. I know that. But this lady's got three quarters of a drink on the table, and the waitress looks at her and says, "Would you like another?" She says the strangest thing of all. She says, "No, I don't care for anymore. I'm beginning to feel it." Oh, well, you know. And, you know, when I get information like that, this is what the alcoholic mind says to me. "You're beginning to feel it. Okay, we need to start ordering tequila shots right now." Because if you're beginning to feel it, there's a window that I got to get to. Because there's a window I got to get in because I'm about to black out and I need to go. I mean, I need to get there. You know, but what I know is that when that lady says that "I don't want anymore, I'm beginning to feel it," what I know is happening is this. I know this today. That the effect of alcohol on her is significantly different than the effect of alcohol on me. When she says, "I don't care for anymore, I'm beginning to feel it," what she's really saying is, "I'm beginning to feel impaired. And I don't like the way that makes me feel, so I'm done. I don't want anymore." That's not the effect alcohol has on me. When I start drinking, I don't feel impaired. I begin to feel empowered. You know, I'm ready to get up and do some Jekyll and Hyde kind of stuff. You know what I mean? We may go on a personal adventure at any moment, right? Maybe an alcoholic expedition. We're going to do one of those tonight. Who knows what we're going to do? But I can tell you this. There's something about my drinking that I have some predictability about, and that's this. I only stop under three conditions: pass out, run out, blackout. Short of that, I'm drinking. If I've got it, it's going. I'm drinking until I'm done. I'm done or it's done. I'm in. I'm just drinking. And I can tell you something else about my drinking. There's always a crash site. I don't know where it's going to be, when it's going to be, or who's going to be involved in it, but there's always a crash site. There just always is. And what my delusion is, I think I just like to party. I think I don't understand that once I take a drink, something different happens to me. How could I know? Why would I know that? I just take a drink and think, "I like to party. This is what I like to do." It's the effect produced by alcohol in me. It's what alcohol does for me. It is that piece of me that quiets that mind. It quiets that disturbance. And I don't know why I have this allergic reaction to alcohol. Because I know people that have allergies to things. I mean, we all know people who have allergic reactions to things. There are people who have allergic reaction to milk. They're lactose intolerant. They drink milk. They get sick. They stay away from milk. They don't have ice cream. They do that kind of stuff. There are people who are allergic to bee stings. They don't go around bees. They stay away from them. There are people who are allergic to peanuts. For God's sake, it's the peanut people. We could spend an hour just talking about them. Well, since y'all brought them up, we'll talk about them. So, the peanut people. These people make one emergency room visit, they quit forever. Seriously. One emergency room visit. They don't have to go to Peanut Anonymous. They don't need a peanut sponsor. They don't even need the peanut book. They don't need any of that. They go to one emergency room visit, almost die. They quit forever, and they mean it. I mean, they'll go to a restaurant. They'll say things like this. They'll go into the maitre d' say, has a peanut been on this city block? I mean, they're vigilant about this. They need to know. And I'll tell you about this. I'll give away cars, houses, families, wives, children, jobs, careers, relationships, integrity, dependability, trustworthiness. Just give it all away. Never connect the dots, it's the booze. Never connect the dots, it's the booze. It's him, it's her, it's them, but it's never the booze. And if it was just that, if it was just those two pieces of alcoholism, if it was just this spiritual malady, if it was just this allergic reaction, you know, my friend Joe would just say to me, Cliff, you're allergic to alcohol, stop drinking and you'll stop running away from home. You'll quit going at large, you know, stop drinking. And I would say, that makes sense, I'm going to stop that. But it's the third piece of alcoholism. It's that other piece, that mental component of alcoholism that totally baffles a guy like me and 100% baffles the people that love me the most. It's that mental piece. It looks something like this. I could come home on a Thursday night, and my sweet wife, Lori, could be cooking dinner. And she would look at me and say, dinner's going to be ready in an hour. We need bread. I need you to go to the store and get bread. And I go, okay. And I get in my car, and I go to the store, and I get the bread. And I walk out of the store. I've got 50 minutes on the clock because I'm up too, man. I'm getting right where I need to go. And I come out, and I run into to Mark. And Mark looks at me and says, what are you doing? And I'm going to say, Lori sent me to the store for bread. I got it, and I'm going to go home. Dinner's going to be ready in 50 minutes. And he would look at me, and he'd say, 50 minutes? Well, 50 minutes. Well, hey, man, we could go over to the log in, have a couple of beers. You'll be home in 50 minutes. Now, when I get that kind of information, I filter that through the keen alcoholic mind. And I know you guys know about the keen alcoholic mind because AA is the only place you hear about that, right? Let me assure you guys that in the Al-Anon rooms, they are not talking about the keen alcoholic mind over there. And so I think about that. Two beers, 50 minutes, I can do that. So on a Thursday night, Mark and I go to the log in with intent to have two beers. Now, Sunday, when I get home, everybody's mad. I mean, she's mad. The kids are mad. Dog, cat, everybody's mad. I don't know why. I got the bread. Right? I mean, I got it. And I don't know if you've ever been in any kind of jackpot like that, but when I get into jackpots like that, I like to get everybody together to tell them the story. Because everybody in this room knows that alcoholics are full of stories. We have stories for everything. Somebody could go to the bathroom and not come back and go, y'all not going to believe this, and just tell us a story about that whole adventure in the bathroom. This is what we do. So I tell them the story, and I roll through it with them. And I go, bread, store, bought, out, Mark. And when I get to Mark, something in my head does this. There's the problem. Mark. Mark's the problem. And I begin to tell the story from a whole different perspective. That if I hadn't run into Mark, I'd be home, and it's not my fault, and it's always the same story. And the crazy part about that is this. I believe that. I believe that's the problem. That wasn't my fault. If I'd not run into him, I'd been home. And then when I get done with this little soliloquy that I'm laying out for him, and I don't really care who's I'm sitting across, but it's generally somebody that I care deeply for. But more importantly, it's somebody who generally loves me unconditionally. And they look across the table from me with, once again, the disappointment one more time. And looking at those people, I say the thing that the only thing I know to say. The only thing that makes sense to me at the time. And it sounds a little different. There's a couple different phrases I've used. You know, I promise, I swear, but it always ends up like this, that I'll never do this again. And you could put a lot of text or test on me and I'll pass it. And the next morning I wake up, it's still pretty chilly at my house. You know, I get in my car and I head to work. And I get traffic going to work, you know, and I get down there to work, as my sponsor says, you know, I get to work where I'm busting my ass 2 or 3 hours a day down there. I'm killing it at work, you know. you know. And I get to think about how they don't really respect me down here and all that stuff. You know, the head's going on that. About one, I'm done getting my car, getting ready to go back home, thinking about going home, how they're mad at me. And then this thought comes to me. I don't know why they're mad at me. I apologized yesterday. And I'm going to tell you something. When I get to that spot in my thinking, I've got maybe on a really good stretch, 24, 36 hours. But more likely within the next couple hours, I'm going to find myself at a bar, or I'm going to find myself at those guys' house, or more importantly, I may be two drinks in, not even remember how I started. Not even remember how I got there and how I started. And here it goes again. And I'm off and running again. And that's the piece of alcoholism. That third piece of alcoholism that a textbook so delicate says, the real problem of the alcoholic center's there. The real problem of the alcoholic center's in our mind, but I don't know that. I don't have any idea about that. I don't know about this three-piece, this spiritual, this physical, this mental. I just think I like to party. And I just don't think they understand. They don't get it. If you had the job that I had, if you had the wife that I have, if you had the kids that I have, if you live with those people, whatever the scenario is, it's never my fault. It's always them. And I'm going to tell you something. I had some people when I was growing up that I drank with. I mean, I had people when I was in college that we would come home for Christmas and we would burn it to the ground, man. We would leave after Christmas and we would stay burned down till New Year's. Just scorched earth policy. And those people looked a lot like me. They drank with me. Man, they were going drink for drink with me. Then something happened to those people. They met him. They met her. They got these great jobs. And you know what they did? They quit. They just quit. And then you know the strangest thing that happened to them? Their lives got better. They started getting promotions at work. They started buying houses. They started having kids. Their lives got better. They just stopped. They just stopped. You know? And of course, you know what my thought is? They're quitters. They're just quitters, you know? They don't know how to have fun because I've got this great life, you know? And in the delusional thinking of how I see my life, I mean, this how I picture it, is it's nothing like what reality is. And I'm one of these guys that when I drink, I take everybody down with me. And, you know, over time, what happened, it got progressively worse. You know, in the early 1990s, I was about 88. They sent me to treatment for the first time, and I came home. And when they sent me to treatment, I went because I hold that professional license. And these people said, hey, if you don't go to treatment, we're going to go down to the Bar Association and tell them what you're doing. Well, I'm stupid. So I said, I'll go. But I want you to know that I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I mean, I didn't think that was my problem. My problem is these people. If they'll just leave me alone, I'll be okay. Because I'm going to tell you what happened for a guy like me. I had no consequences. I mean, I continued to be successful in my practice, and people would push pillows under me. And I would have things happen, and they would just throw pillows under me, and I never really had consequences. And so I go to treatment, and I come back, and I said, you got to go to AA. And I did a tour through AA. You know, I was around AA, which means I just went to a couple of meetings and went back doing exactly what I wanted to do. Because that's not my problem. I don't have that problem. I mean, I know what a real alcoholic is. I grew up, my dad had that liquor store. I knew what alcoholics were. I used to see them on Saturday morning when we would go in when I was like a kid. When we would go in, they would be in the parking lot. They have those alcoholic cars. I saw a couple here in the parking lot we pulled here. You know alcoholic cars. There's two doors that don't match, you know. And there's always some cardboard and some duct tape, right? Baling wire generally involved somewhere. All four tires on the ground, two are donuts, though. You know, never just alcoholic cars, man. And my dad would be in there. They'd be out in the car. My dad would open the door. It's like they got beamed from the Starship Enterprise. They'd just be on the front step, you know. And they would come in. They'd buy the good stuff, you know, Wild Irish Rose, or they'd get Seagram 7 or Gilby's Gin. Always in half pints, because alcoholics are the only people that buy half pints, you know. They put it in their boot or whatever. Then they'd buy that vodka, you know, the one on the bottom shelf, you know, 40 cents a half pint, all consonant, no vowels, that stuff, you know, just you know, Joe, you drank that. And And there was like two steps up to my dad's liquor store. And I'm going to tell you, about every 6 weeks, one of those drunks, you know, they'd be a little Jake leg. They'd hit a heel on that top step. Down they go. My dad would call me. I had to go sweep that up, you know. And I'd be thinking, these drunks, they can't even find a decent hour to get a drink, you know. And I remember when I was working at that big law firm in downtown Oklahoma City, and I was at 23rd and Robinson, which is 23 blocks from downtown. I can see all those high-rise buildings there. It's 9:45, liquor store's open at 10. And I'm sitting in front of Byron's, the largest liquor store in Oklahoma City. I can see downtown. I'm in a three-piece suit. And I could have given you 100 reasons why I'm different from those people in front of my dad's liquor store. Could have given you 100 reasons. And I can see downtown Oklahoma City, and I'm here. My car, all my tires match, all the doors match, no cardboard, no baling wire. 100 reasons why I'm different from me. But see, what happens is it's not about the outside. It's not about the external factors. It's about what's going on in here. And I'm just like those poor drunks that would show up at my dad's house, and I'm 24 years old. Just the same. Just the same. Anyway, I had this big law firm that I had started in about 1989, and in about 1994, somewhere out in there, you know, my alcoholism, my drinking career, as the book describes, overtook my legal career. And I had the inability to come back to work. I had 30 people that reported directly to me, first name partner in a big law firm in downtown Oklahoma City. And I tell you that to not tell you what a big shot I was, because I thought I was. What I know today is a big shot's just a squirt under pressure. That's what I know today, man. But back then, I would have told you I was somebody, you know. I'm doing all this stuff, that I got all these things. I'm going to tell you something. It didn't matter how much stuff I had. It didn't matter what the title was. It didn't matter what cars were parked in my garage. It didn't matter what I felt, where I live. Every morning when I woke up, it was the same feeling. I'm different from. I'm not like those people. And I continued to try to change my external circumstances, thinking if I can get to here, I'll be okay. If I can get this, I'll be all right. If I ever hit this mark, I'll be okay. And every time I'd hit a mark, it was never enough. It's never enough. It didn't matter what I accumulated externally. Internally, it was always the same. After a day or two, it faded, and I'm just back left with me. And some people talk about this hole in our soul, you know, this darkness. I used to think about it like a hole in my soul. But I've come to view it as a different way today. I don't really think it's a hole in my soul. What I really think it is I think I've created this mountain of garbage in my life. I've created this mountain of resentments. I've created this mountains of fear, bad sex conduct, harms to others. I've created this mountain, and it's blocked me off from the sunlight of the Spirit, and it appears from the shadow to look like a hole. It looks like a hole because of this shadow, that this mountain of wreckage that I've created that has totally blocked the sun off, and it looks like a hole. If you looked at me, you'd say it was a hole, but it's a shadow. It's a shadow from all this wreckage. And so what happened is that law firm got evicted from that building. And I became, as Bill described his story, unwelcome hanger-on around Oklahoma City. People would take me in for about 6 months, figure out who I was, and off I'd be. Somewhere in there, towards the later part of my drinking, I met my wife, Lori, and I've been together since 1995, married since 2000, since 99, my sober date 2001. She was front row seat all of the end, at the end. And she had this great job. She was working for a radio company, and right when sports radio started taking off in the early to mid-90s. And she was the first female to sell radio advertising for sports radio in Oklahoma. And she's a beautiful woman, so of course her life was just exploding, and mine was tanking. And she was making all this money. So I like to tell people that period of time in my life when all that was happening, got evicted. This is when I became a functioning alcoholic. I had a wife that worked, you know. I tell you, I was a real go-getter. I'd take her to work and go get her. That's what I would do. Right? And she and I got married in 90. And, you know, she just had a front row seat. And I don't know what it is about alcoholics. We get the best women, man. We get the best people in our life. And I just put her through the torture chamber. Well, finally, in the summer of 2001, she just had all she could stand. And she came home, and she's put me out on the street. and I came up with my very first newcomer plan. So if you're new or you're nearly new, listen up. It's vitally important you have a newcomer plan when you get here. This was my newcomer plan in the summer 2001 when she threw me out. I'm going to go to AA, tell her I'm going to AA, till she settles down and I get back in the house. Because my problem when I go to AA in the summer, June of 2001, was not that I was alcoholic. I wasn't. My problem was homelessness. That was my problem. And I need to get back in the house. Right? So I'm going to go to AA and tell her I'm going to AA, and I'm going to hang on until she lets me back in. Then I'm going to go live my life the way I want to live it. And it's a great plan, by the way, unless you're alcoholic. It's not very good at all. But I went to AA, and I started going every day to this meeting in Oklahoma City, this noon meeting. And I would sit in that meeting and suffer. I would suffer. Because every day, the four horsemen get up, and they ride with me all day long. And I would get up with restless, irritable discontentedness. 41 years of it. Every morning, I'm getting up, and they ride all day long with me. And I'm sitting in AA, and I'm just not drinking. And what I discovered in that summer was I am not like my friends. You know the ones that just quit drinking and their life got better? I'm going to tell you, summer 2001, I quit drinking. My life got worse not drinking. You remove alcohol from this alcoholic, and you don't put me on any kind of else other than just go get them. Just don't drink and go to drink meetings. Just don't drink and go to meetings will kill an alcoholic like me. Because I sat that meeting for 45 days, and every day this is all I thought about. How can I drink and how do I stay sober? How can I drink and how can I stay sober? Now, I'm going to try to beat the laws of physics. You know, I can drink and not get drunk. I've got to figure that out. Because you know how we are. At any given moment, all of us are the smartest person in the room at any given moment, right? How do I drink and how do I stay sober? I lasted 45 days. On the 45th day, I got out of a noon meeting on a Thursday of Alcoholics Anonymous and went right to a bar because I couldn't take it anymore. I can't live here. See, it's not drinking's my problem. Sobriety is my problem. Sobriety is so raw on me. Having to deal with the world and living in this system is no good. See, drinking is my solution. It's not my problem. And now I've eliminated my solution. I'm just living raw out in the world, and I don't know how to do that. I don't have the substitute that Alcoholics Anonymous and 12 Steps give me. I don't have a spiritual path that I'm trying to walk on. I'm not seeking anything but trying to figure out how to get through this to get the next drink. That's it. And I got up out of that meeting on a Thursday. I went drinking, and I went at large again. I didn't come home till Sunday. No phone, no nothing. Nobody could find me. Nobody could get hold of me. I wander in Sunday night about 8 o'clock. Nobody happy to see me. That's when I found out again that it was more her house than mine, you know. And so I got tossed out again. But that's all right, because on August the 15th of 2001, I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I sat down. I didn't know it was going to be the day I sat down in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I really believe this for the majority of the men in this room today. If we did a poll and a survey and we just talked about the sobriety date, I think that most of us generally would say we would have been just as good to take a dart and throw it out of calendar. I had no intention to get sober on August the 15th, 01. And if you're new or you're nearly new and you're in Alcoholics Anonymous, I got some really good news for you. If you're here this weekend and you're thinking, yeah, I'm coming and I'm going to do all this, but I have no intention of getting sober, perfect. Because I didn't have any intention of getting sober either. On that day when I had been beaten into a state of reasonableness, I did not know that. I did not know I had been beaten into that state. I came in thinking, I just got to get a new newcomer plan. I got to give it 90 days. I got to figure out how to get over the 45-day hump, but this is not my problem. And so I got good news for you. You don't have to want to be sober to get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Let me say that again. You don't have to want to be sober to get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Why? That's my experience. I didn't want to get sober. I didn't come here with any intention to get sober. I just need the heat off me. I need to get that off me to get back in the house and let me just live my life the way I want to live it. But I'm sitting in Alcoholics Anonymous on August 15, 2001. Nothing has changed about me. My thoughts are still the same. How do I drink? How do I stay sober? Charlie Brown's people are there. Wonk, 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 wonk. That's all you people say in there. And there's 5 minutes left in this meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and my head went stone cold quiet. Now, if you're a person that has a lot going on up here and your head goes quiet, that's an attention getter. And I move right to the edge of my seat. And this thought came to me. And the thought was this: if you don't do something different today, you're going to die. And that got my attention. And about 2 minutes later, you guys ended your meeting and you stood up and you circled up, you held hands, you said the Lord's Prayer. And even after hearing that thought, my only thing I know, the only thing I've ever done is I just ran. I just broke for the door because I'm terrified. I live on fear. Fear feeds everything in my life. And I have this thought, and I just need to get away. If I just get away, it'll be all right. But what I didn't tell you guys is that for the 45 days I had been going to AA, there had been an old man there. And every day after those noon meetings, that old man would catch me. And he would look at me and he'd say, "Bub, how are you doing?" And I would give him the alcoholic answer, "Fine, fine, fine." And he would just look at me and say, "Well, listen, if there's ever anything I can do for you." And I would think, "There's nothing you could do for me." Off I'd go. That old man did that for 45 days for me. Every day, he would catch me. He'd just ask me, "How are you doing? If there's ever anything I can do for you, let me know." He did that every day for me. And on August the 15th, 2001, I hear that saying in my head, "If you don't do something different today, you're going to die." I broke for the door, and old Don caught me one more time on August the 15th, 2001. And he stopped me at the door, and he looked at me, and he said, "Bub, how are you doing?" And I'm going to tell you something. I gave him a different answer on that day. I just looked at him, and I said, "Man, Don, I'm not doing good at all." And he looked at me in all seriousness, and he goes, "I know." And he says, "Well, look, if there's anything I can ever do for you, let me know." And in my head, it thought, "Man, there's nothing you can do for me. I'm maladjusted at life, right? I'm an outright mental defective. I'm thinking, nobody can help me." But out of my mouth came this: "I need a sponsor." Let me tell you about Don. You all know Don. You don't know Don, but you know him. Don was this guy that had the fundamental belief that if you weren't at the meeting 30 minutes before it started, you're late. You're late. I mean, Don would get there 30 minutes early. He would set the tables up. He'd start making coffee, put the books out of his literature meeting. I mean, he'd do all that, and then he would be sitting out in the front in kind of the ante room, and he'd have some people out there, what I would call time acolytes, because that's all they did was read, write, pray out there. That's all they do, you know. And then they would float into the meeting room, you know. They float in. And they would, I don't know how they do it where you guys do AA. I'm sure it's wrong, but in Oklahoma, when they start the meeting, they eventually ask, "Is there any AA-related announcements?" And, you know, Don would hand up every day. And he would talk forever, sometimes 30, 45 seconds, about everything going on in AA worldwide, it seemed like. And if there was a newcomer there, Don and the acolytes would be on them like chickens on a June bug, man. They'd just go into attack mode, you know, and they'd be writing in their book, giving them numbers. But old Don would stand back and wait till they were done, and he would do something different. Don would certainly, of course, give his number, but he would get your number, and he would call you. Because what Don knew that the acolytes didn't know is that no drinking drunk can pick up the 10,000-pound phone and call. So he'd call you. So my hope is that you have or have had somebody in your life like Don, because Don saved my life. And I just said, you know, "I need a sponsor." And he got excited. I mean, he started gyrating around. I thought he was going to pee his pants. Really, I did. And he said, "Well, let's sit down and talk about that." And I thought that was a great idea, quite frankly. And Don set me down. And what he did for me on that day is he began to speak to me in the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. He began to talk to me from the language of the heart. And I don't know how many AA meetings I'd been to. I told you I'd been to treatment. I don't know. But see, I don't have alcoholism. That's not my problem. I've never had alcoholism up until that moment. And in that moment, when Don began to talk to me, I began to suffer from alcoholism. And I don't know how long Don and I sat there and talked. It was a bit. But when Don got done talking to me, I'm this guy that just pushes all of his imaginary chips to the middle of the table. And I went all in on Alcoholics Anonymous. Had no idea what that was going to look like. Had no idea what was going to happen to me. But I just pushed him to the middle of the table. Had no idea. But I can tell you something. On that day, I was out of plans and ideas. And quite frankly, I think it's the best spot you can catch an alcoholic in. I think the best spot to catch an alcoholic is when they're out of plans and ideas. Because in that moment, you know, we talk about a lot around here. We talk about finding bottom. The book talks about an incomprehensible demoralization. I'm going to tell you how I perceive it, what happened to me on that day. It's a moment of grace. It's just a moment of grace. It's that moment in time when God cracked my heart and he allowed me to stand in the crevice and see me for maybe the very first time exactly who and what I was. I got to see me who I really was on that day. And in that moment, I'm in. I can see the devastation. I can see it all in an instant. And Don put me on this path. And he's the guy that was in the book. And he was a step guy. And he got me in 1, 2, 3. And he had me do an inventory. I'm making amends at about month 2. I'm out cleaning up the wreckage of my past, you know. He's got me moving. He's got me involved in stuff. He's put me on committees. I mean, I didn't want all this. Don was that guy, you know, when you show up, you know, I told you he wanted you to be there 30 minutes early. And you guys remember when you're new in sobriety? I mean, like the last place you want to be is AA, you know, initially. You don't want to really go there. And now you got to be there 30 minutes early. That's no good. That's not good at all. He had me making coffee, and I'm making coffee. I'm meeting people. I'm being a part of suddenly. I'm kind of feeling like I'm part of this deal called Alcoholics Anonymous. Don gave me this coffee commitment. One day I showed up. Somebody else was there making coffee. My God, I had to get there 10 minutes earlier the next day. I had to get my coffee commitment back, man. And it's that kind of stuff. See, I think if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, when new people walk in our door, the first thing we need to do is give them a job. Give them a job in AA, man. That's what happened to me. They gave me a job in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know what happened? I became part of something. Something bigger than me. And I'm going to tell you, I couldn't bite off this power greater than myself. I couldn't bite off this God deal. It's not that I didn't believe in something. I just think God had, you know, had just forgot about me. And I figured this, I made this deal with God. You know, you do your thing, I do mine, never our paths cross. You know, the only thing about this I'm going to tell you about is God never dwelt on his part of the deal. He was always there. I'm the guy that was left. I'm the guy that moved. My old sponsor used to always say, if you're not feeling close to God, you need to see who moved. And if you want to feel closer to God, you need to figure out who needs to move back. And so he got me these steps in the books, got me involved. I started becoming part of conference committees and, you know, anniversary committees, and I became a part of AA. And I remember sometime we're about 60 to 90 days, somebody came up to me and said, how long you been sober? 60, 90 days, whatever it was. And he looked at me and said, oh, you're in the easy part, the quit drinking part. And I thought, I'm going to kick his ass is what I'm going to do. He's bigger than me, but I can take him, I think, you know. I'm young. But he was right. Because it was the easy part, the quitting drinking. It's life is what I have difficulty with. It's sobriety I have difficulty with. But what happened is I began to watch men like you. And you did for me exactly what the textbook talks about. You became the demonstration of Alcoholics Anonymous. You became a demonstration. You became the vision of the big book. You sat in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. You talk about getting married and not drinking. You talk about getting divorced, not drinking. You talk about your kid on drugs, not drinking. You talk about your kid dying, not drinking. You talk about your parents dying, not drinking. All that stuff. You talk about new job, lost job. You talk about life, not drinking. You'd end it by saying, you know, but I'm happy, joyous, and free. And I never once thought about drinking and all that part. And I began to watch the demonstration. You know what it gave me? Hope. That by God, if I just did this, if I just followed you men around, maybe this could work for me too. You know what happened for me is when that I got to look up that 60, 90 days not drinking, I began to believe something was working for me, had faith. And you know what faith is? It's hope with a track record. That's all faith is. And I began to have some of that here. because I get to watch you guys, and you guys started having this miraculous life. And Alcoholics Anonymous began to work in my life. And I did exactly what Ryan talked about. I did those 12, those 11 steps, and the 12th one came true for me. I had a spiritual experience as the result of these steps. I became open to the possibilities that my thinking was not necessarily my best friend. I came open to the possibility that if I just listened to you people and did what you did, followed you around, that somehow my life would get better. And it has come to pass that that has been true for me. I can remember when my drinking days, I was setting up, when I would, back in my drinking days, I used to also like to do some other things that would help me stay up late at night and for extended periods of time that would allow me to drink more. I was the unofficial night watchman in my neighborhood for a number of years, just to be clear about that. It was an uncompensated position, but nonetheless, I was there. And I can remember there was a time that I was watching late night television with infomercials. You guys ever watch those infomercials? You guys ever seen this commercial for OxyClean? You ever seen this stuff? It's amazing, right? Amazing. I've been up for about 3 days and drinking, and I'm flipping the channels at 3 a.m, and this OxyClean guy comes on. His name is Billy something. Billy Bays, that's it. And so, 3 a.m. guy. There's my guy back there, buddy. And so I just stick, and Billy starts pitching OxyClean. And he's got this big clear tub, and his agitator's going, and it's moving, and he's talking about OxyClean. He's talking about, and he holds up this dirty shirt, white t-shirt, throws some OxyClean in, and he's talking about the problem, you know. And he throws this powder in, and there's the solution, right? Talking, I'm wrapped, man. I've moved to the edge of my stool at this point, you know. And he throws that t-shirt in, and he keeps talking, and I'm focused. And, you know, he reaches in, pulls out a tub, and shazam, clean. I mean, it is white. And I thought, my God, I need this in my life. And so I hadn't worked in about 3 years. In the last 3 years of my drinking, I didn't work because I had that wife that worked, right? So I don't have no money, but I went and got her credit card, and I ordered some of this stuff. I told Lori the next day, Joe, she wasn't excited as you guys are right now, I'll tell you that. Whatever. So I ordered this stuff, and 4 to 6 weeks, it shows up, and I get it, and so I start using it in the laundry, and it works. Matter of fact, it works so good, I start putting it in the dishwasher. Hell, I just start practicing all my affairs, man. This just works, you know? And at some point along there, I ran out. I ran out of OxyClean. Well, now, when I ran out, I didn't need to stay up till 3 a.m. to catch another one of those infomercials, you know what I mean? I had some practical experience with it. I knew it would work. I had hope when I watched old Billy that this might work for me, and I started doing that, and it worked. Now I had faith it's going to work. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what you people did for me. I came here and watched your demonstrations. I had hope it would work for me. I stayed here long enough that it began to work for me, and I began to have the faith that it would do that. And I got a connection to a power greater than myself. And through that power, what's happened for me is this just a miraculous life that we all get a part to be of. I've heard speakers stand behind this podium or share in meetings and talk about this big life they got. I've got this big life now. I don't think I got a big life. What I think I got is just this ordinary life today. I've got an ordinary life. I get up and I go to work and I stay all day. You know, I stay all day. And at the end of the day, I come home. And I come home to the right house, to the right wife. I know that because she knows my name when I get there, right? She says the whole name. I know it's me that she's looking for. Right? And I've got this. And I have this professional life. And when I'm in downtown Oklahoma City, there was a period of time I couldn't even go out of my office. I was paralyzed by fear. But yesterday I spent 3 hours over in federal court because I'm on the rules committee. And for the last couple years, we've been working on revamping the rules. I'm a bankruptcy lawyer. We've been working on revamping the rules because they invited me to be part of that. They asked me to be on that committee. And so yesterday for 2 hours, I was with the judges and a couple other guys hammering out these rules. I've got a life today. I've got this. I'm participating in life today. And my neighbors next door to me, they got these two little girls and they're wonderful. And we go out, Lori and I, about every month or so, we will go out the two, the mom and dad and these two little girls, they're 8 and 5. We all go out and have dinner together. And they text us, say, hey, it was time for dinner again. And they want to go out with us, and they want to be, and I get to be a part of that. I get to go participate in my neighborhood. I'm a part of my community. I get to do that because I have a full life today. It's not big, it's not great, it's ordinary. It is extraordinary, ordinary. It is totally vanilla. But I have that today. And I'm a part of something. I'm a part of my community. I'm a part of my town. I'm a part of my profession. And you did that for me because you showed me how to do that. I'm a husband today in good standing. In good standing in my household because I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to have a monogamous relationship with one woman, but you showed me that. You taught me how to do that. You taught me how to be a husband. You taught me how to be a father, to be a neighbor, to be a good employee. You taught me all that. And you taught me how to be a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's days gets up that I don't want to be any of that. There are days I get up, I don't want to be part of any of that, you know, because I still suffer from alcoholism, not alcoholism. And, you know, I get involved in AA and I have this life. And, you know, sometimes in AA, you know, I've got to do some pretty cool things. You know, I've got to go do some places. I've got to do some things. And I was involved in service for a while. And I was GSR, DCM. I was area chair. And, you know, we get these titles. We begin to think we're somebody, get some platitudes, you know. We begin to think we're something. I want to tell you some stories about that this weekend, too. But I want to set the stage for you. I want you to just take a trip back from me. 1 minute. We're going to tell this story and we'll get out of here. I want you to just come back with me, and we're going to go to Palm Sunday. And we're outside the gates of the holy city of Jerusalem. And it's packed. It is packed. You couldn't get another person in the city because the Messiah is coming. And the people are crowded because they all want to look, right? They want to look. They want to see. They want to see this Messiah. And the town is full. The Romans are worried because they got all the Jewish people there, and they're excited, and the Romans are worried. And in comes Jesus on a donkey. And the people begin to cheer, and the people begin to push against each other. And they're cheering, and they're crying out the name of the Messiah. And what if in that moment, in that crowd, with all those people excited, that just for an instant, the donkey thought, this is all for me. And haven't I been guilty of that? Haven't I been guilty of that in Alcoholics Anonymous? Haven't I come here and taken advantage of things and have gotten to do a couple things and maybe got to chair a meeting or talk at a group or, you know, and begin to think of that. I see myself at this perfect program, so divinely inspired by this power of that reigns over Alcoholics Anonymous. Haven't I been guilty of that? Isn't it really more about you people? The people I've met, the relationships I've got along the way, the people that have been part of that, you know, the people that have become ingrained in my life in Alcoholics Anonymous, the many things that I've had an opportunity to do, they're great, but man, isn't it more important the people I've come across, the times I've sat down and conversations I've shared with them? And so as we gather here this weekend, you know, as we go, we're going to have this great weekend together. But one thing I've got to always remember, that I'm just the ass carrying the message. Thanks for having me.